The Lord be with you. You're listening to a podcast from the teaching ministry of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community. For more multimedia content or to get more information, go to www.epiclesis.org. Now, here's Pastor Chris.
Hi, folks, and welcome back to another teaching from Epiclesis, an ancient future faith church in Sacramento, California. On this first Sunday in Advent, 2025, Dr. J. Dudley introduced us to a fascinating person. He was the Chinese diplomat, politician, and lawyer named Wellington Koo. Along the way, Jay also asked us this: what matters most when it comes to being ready for the return of Jesus? Well, the essence of readiness appears in a discernible pattern in some crucial words of the Lord Himself. Join us, please, as Dr. Jay Dudley leads us in a teaching he titled, Jesus and Wellington Koo. The Lord be with you.
Those ancient words appointed for today are in Matthew 24, beginning with verse 36. No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in the field, one will be taken, and the other left. Two women will be grinding with a handmill, one will be taken, and the other left. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. But understand this: if the owner of the house had known what time of night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have let his house be broken into. So you also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the master has put in charge of the servants of his household to give them their food at the proper time? It will be good for that servant whose master finds him doing so when he returns. I tell you the truth, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But suppose that servant is wicked and says to himself, my master's staying away a long time. And then he begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and act and eat and drink with drunkards. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour he is not aware of, he will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. This morning, let's pretend. Let's pretend that you find yourself at a holiday party, and somehow, in the group that you're conversing with, the chat degenerates into how bad things are and how bad they are getting and how they're staying that way and just getting worse and worse everywhere in the world. And someone says to you, do you think there's any hope? And you have the audacity to say, I believe that ultimately the only hope for the world lies in the return of Jesus Christ. And someone chokes on our martini, and a couple of people peel off out of the crowd, and then one guy stays, and he looks right at you, and he sips his gin and tonic and says to you, you know, I heard that stuff all through my Sunday school years, and the church has heard it for 2,000 plus years, and the world has listened in, and they've heard it, and nothing ever happens, and nothing ever changes, and it hasn't happened, and probably won't, and it sounds like an old, bad old joke, and isn't that kind of embarrassing to you? And then he peels off and leaves you standing there. And you wonder, well, What would I have said to him if he'd stayed? And after a few moments, you gather your wits about you, and this realization comes to mind. It's like Jesus is on trial, and they are judge and jury, and he's been weighed and found wanting. Well then, let's distinguish ourselves. Let's not take that well-worn road. Let's take the other road, the one that not many people find, the way suggested in a beautiful biblical proverb, wonderfully translated in the New Jerusalem Bible, like this. It's Proverbs 15:33. The fear of Yahweh is a school of wisdom. Before there can be glory, there must be humility. And with a willingness to be in that school, let's turn to the words of our Lord Jesus Christ, but with courtesy and respect and humility that's due him, and attend to those words, perhaps more carefully than we ever have before. Notice the pattern. He begins with a precedent, as it was in the days of Noah. That's how it will be when the Son of Man returns, verses 37 to 39. That precedent is followed by an appeal. Therefore, keep watch, in verse 42. After the precedent of the flood, Jesus offers an analogy of the homeowner. The guy, if he had known, he wouldn't have let this happen. He would have taken precautions. Followed by an appeal. So you must also be ready. Just like the homeowner wasn't, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. The pattern begins to appear. Because after the analogy of the homeowner, Jesus floats a question. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the master has put in charge of the servants of his household to give them their food at the proper time? That question is followed by an appeal in the form of a promised reward in verse 46, staggering. It will be good for that servant whose master finds him doing so when he returns. I tell you the truth, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. Then comes the plot twist. Well, what if the servant's wicked? And what if he says, my master's been away a long time. I'm gonna mess around, man. I'm gonna have a good time. Well, that's followed by a threat, right? In verse 48, the threat. Well, he'll come on a day when he does not expect him. This is actually verse 50. And hour he's not aware of, and he will cut him to pieces and assign him with a place in the hypocrites. That means, not literally cutting him in pieces, but a tongue lashing, perhaps? Anyway, there's a threat there. So here's his pattern. Precedent, analogy, question, plot twist, all followed by an appeal to thoughtful, consequent action. Because this is going to happen, therefore do this or be this. The pattern means something. It holds real significance, real significance. A significance perhaps best understood by contrast. So to help us grasp the contrast, here's a little comic relief. It's a true story, and it's in stark dissimilarity, I should say, from what Jesus is projecting here. There was a great diplomatic conference, and at the final dinner of this great international diplomatic conference, an American delegate was seated next to the Chinese delegate, and the dinner began, and wanting to make conversation, the American delegate asked the Chinese delegate next to him about the soup. He wanted to know if the soup was okay. And he goes, likey soupy? And the Chinese delegate smiled, nodded, didn't say anything. This Chinese diplomat was Wellington Koo, PhD, Columbia University, Ku had served as the Republic of China's ambassador to France and Great Britain during World War II, and in 1945 represented China at the signing of the Charter of the United Nations, and from 46 to 56 served as China's ambassador to the United States and sat as judge at The Hague in the International Court of Justice from 1957 to 1967. The American delegate knew nothing about this. Didn't know who he was sitting next to. And a little later in the meal, the American delegate looked over at the Chinese delegate and said, "Likey meaty?" And the delegate, Chinese guy, nodded, smiled. A little later, unbelievably, the American delegate says, "Likey fruity?" Same response. The meal's drawing to a close. The MC for the evening invites the speaker of the evening to the platform. The speaker is Wellington Koo, who stood, walked to the podium, gave a brilliant, penetrating, witty address on an international subject, and then sat down by the American delegate and looked at him and said, "Likey speechy?" Wellington Koo let the preposterous American hang himself. The American didn't have a clue about Koo, and Koo didn't give him one. He gave him a well-deserved comeuppance. Jesus, in Matthew 24, is very un-Koo-like. He intends here to prevent comeuppance. Don't want that. When all is said and done, he doesn't want to say to us the equivalent of, "Likey speechy." He wants to say, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." Jesus' whole intent is that we do not embarrass ourselves, but that we distinguish ourselves. Not that we get caught off guard, but that we be found on task. When he returns, his desire and design is not our failure, but our success. That is the significance of the pattern. Precedent, appeal. Analogy, appeal. Question, appeal. Plot twist, appeal. Threat, don't let this happen to you. So the first thing for us to get straight here is that Jesus is not on trial. His return is a given. It is an ironclad certainty. The question is not, is he coming? The question isn't even, when is he coming? He's coming. The second thing to get clear on is, well, who is actually on trial then? Me. And you. The question really is, who then is the faithful and wise servant? That's the one that really matters. And the third thing is, what role do we play? We need to get clear about this. What role do we play in this drama? Well, the answer is, we're not the master, we're the steward. We're the one that has been given some responsibilities on behalf of the master. And remember, he's not playing Wellington Koo here. His goal is that we succeed at this. So the question is, again, who is the faithful and wise servant? And how do we get to the place where we can humbly and truly answer that question? By the grace of God. Me. I'm one. So let me illustrate this by switching metaphors from master steward to doctor patient. I was standing out in a trout stream in Montana, and the wind came up and my eyes started flooding. I just flooding with liquid, and I couldn't see. It's kind of a weird thing. So I asked my eye doctor, Randy First, whom some of you know. I went to see him and I said, "Man, what is going on?" And he goes, "Well, You have dry eye syndrome, and your eyes aren't supplying enough liquid naturally. And so you're kind of low, and when you get the wind effect and it hits your eyes and it dries them out, it really pours it on to protect your eyes. He explained it better than that, but that's the essential truth of it. So, okay, he says, we can fix that. And he put me on a protocol of all the things I was supposed to do, the drops and this, and so on and so forth, and the heat and everything. And so he says, come back and see me in 3 months. I did it. Came back and see him in 3 months. Went through all the questionnaire and the whole thing, and he looked me all over. And I could see that as he went on, he was starting to get kind of giddy. It's like he was almost like skipping or dancing around the room. And I said, Doctor, what you're happy. What are you so happy about? He says, do you know what the number one problem in medicine is? I said, I do not. He said, it's patient compliance. Look at these people who are nodding. He said, people don't do what the doctor tells them to do. Really? I said, yeah. He goes, I got a patient who was new with new contact lenses. He came in practically screaming. His eyes are burning. He's having a heck of a time. I said, I asked him, he said, do you ever clean these things? He goes, no, I didn't. I just put them in and leave them right there. You know what happens to contacts that never are cleaned? They accumulate all that. The guy was in pain. The doctor was exasperated, had to go through the whole cleaning training thing again. He says, you have no idea how rare you are. He goes, you did what I told you to do. I'm ecstatic. In contrast, okay. Another medical thing. Not last August, but the August before that. And this is a personal thing, and I'm just telling you because it's real. 2 Augusts ago, I found out that I have atrial fibrillation. Not a big deal, common thing. But the doctor said, I want you to consider taking a blood thinner to avoid stroke and heart attack. And I said, okay. And then he said, I want you to walk vigorously 30 minutes at least every day, work up a sweat and lose some weight. Okay, so I started doing that. Well, okay, then along come April of this year, I find out I'm pre-diabetic. And the doctor said, you got two choices. You can either take pills or you can make a lifestyle change. And I said, I'll take the lifestyle change. And he said, I concur with that. And I said, what does that mean? He goes, reducing your carbohydrate intake to 150 grams a day. That was an abstraction to me. I had no idea what that meant. Wow. I had to get a carb app on my phone to track my carbohydrates. It's like having 150 carbs in the bank, and you can spend them any way you want to, but stop at 150. So, long story short, with that combination of the walking every day, almost, missed yesterday, and the carbohydrate reduction, I've lost 17 pounds since April. I'm just being silly. The point is that, well, let me, like I said to Dr. First, my eye doctor, I said, when he told me, he asked me about what's the main problem in medicine? I said, I don't know. And he said, patient compliance. I said, doctor, do you know what the main problem in church is? I said, no. He said, no, I don't. I said, it's disciple compliance. We don't do what the Lord's told us to do. He kind of shook him up a little bit. He goes, man, never thought of that. I guess you're right. So the whole point here in telling you those two stories is that success came through, in my case, patient compliance, doing what the doctor told me to do. The doctor's over here nodding, giving me a lot of support here. The answer is steward compliance, doing what the master wants us to do. So what does Dr. Jesus want us to do? Going back to that metaphor. Okay, we're toggling back and forth. We need to come back to the master's steward image that Jesus gave us. It's in the answer about what he wants us to do. It's in verses 45 to 48, or actually the contrast between the two. 45 is, of course, who then is the wise and faithful servant whom the master has put in charge of the servants in his household to give him their food at their proper time. Give them their food at the proper time. That's the big thing right there. And you go down to 48, and what happens is this steward who is thinking that his master's been away, hey, you've been away a long time, and he starts beating his servants, abusing people, and eating and drinking with drunkards, abusing himself. So what does the master really, what does he want us to do? What does it mean to steward our stewardship from him? It's about the people God has given us. It's giving them their food at the proper time. That's emblematic of doing the right thing by them. Spouse, children, neighbors, associates, employees. It's about being their ally, not their enemy. It's about being for them, not against them. It's about not neglecting them, abusing them, or abandoning them. Simply stated, people matter most. People matter to the master. Being good to them, being good for them, being the one they want to see coming, not the one they hate to see coming. Am I just sounding like a 19th century liberal? Just, you know, do-gooder? Well, I hope not. I hope I'm sounding more like a 7th century prophet named Micah, who said to me the most magnificent, the absolute Himalayas of the Old Testament, and what doth the Lord require of thee but to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with thy God? Look back at Jesus' critique of the Pharisees. He scorches them for devouring widows' houses. He scorches them for laying burdens on people, religious burdens, and doing nothing to lift them. He scorches them for treating their animals better than people. And if you jump ahead to Matthew 25, you get into that piece about the very end, which Mother Teresa talks about, Jesus appearing in his distressing disguise. The king will reply, I tell you the truth. Whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me. Caring deeply, actively about the people God has given us, that is absolutely critical, the critical task. It's very simply loving people. It's part of the Great Commandment, it's half of it. Love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, mind, and strength. And what? My neighbor as thyself. He's just saying it another way. Remember the cynic at the holiday party, the guy that thought you ought to be embarrassed because Jesus hasn't come back yet? We've been to school this morning, and I wonder, are you ready to respond to that guy? I am. Let's go find him. Oh, there he is, right there. Let's go find him. Hey, would you mind if I spoke to you as frankly as you spoke to me? Okay, here it goes. I just want you to know two things. I am not embarrassed because Jesus hasn't returned on my personal schedule. The second thing is, at the very center of the universe is a magnificent, massive love. That love sent Jesus to this earth for the first time. And that love will send him back again. And friend, that love seeks you, wants you, and welcomes you. You are loved, wanted, and welcome. Here's my contact information. Call anytime, and we can talk. And in heaven, there are smiles because you are doing justly. You are loving mercy. You are walking humbly with your God. After all, the fear of Yahweh is a school of wisdom. Before there can be glory, there must be humility. The main message is glory awaits. It is the promise of the Lord. Matthew 24, 46. It will be good for that servant the master finds doing so when he comes. The understatement of the centuries, it will be good. Oh man, it will be good. It will be good. It will be. Let's keep that right in here, right in front. Let's keep it right here. Remember, it's going to be good. And just love people for Jesus' sake and for our own. Amen.
You've been listening to a podcast from Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community. If you'd like to learn more about ancient future faith or worship with us at Epiclesis, visit us on the web at www.epiclesis.org. The Lord be with you.